I intended to leave you with a summary and rest stop for the series of the last four posts, a crisp, meme-worthy resolution. To recap so far, 1. Our dual worlds, the physical world of atoms, tangible evidence, and sensation, and the epistemic world of symbols, words, meanings, narratives. 2. Their connections, the PE nexus, which forms a foundation of our humanity. 3. The contrasts and conflicts, including the PE drift that happens over time. 4. Their breaking apart entirely. There were two possible destinations in my journey, the dark and the light. I went back and forth a half dozen times, drafting, redrafting, trashing, starting over. The summer heat didn't ease my malaise any. At last, I broke through my mental logjam by realizing I'd been framing this as an either-or dilemma, dark or light, when it's more useful to see it as both and. I always try to consider both the upside and downside implications of any given thing, rather than stashing them away into tidy, separate mental threat and opportunity buckets, as is common practice. Threat and opportunity are not separate. They're different sides of the same coin, an example of what I call strategic ambiguity. How can we thread the needle between the dark and the light extremes? In short, we need to flip the narrative on itself. The dark narrative. The dystopian narrative plays like this. We have broken the primal humanity-defining connection between the epistemic and the physical. Our narratives have become unhinged, untethered from empirical reality. We're drowning in disinformation and in existential challenges to our epistemic structures and authorities, our basic instincts for truth. The post-Enlightenment thinking that has made our material lives overall much better than they were in, say, the 16th century, is under siege and may not survive intact. We may be going backwards. Scary, right? While this may hold some truth, there are several problems. 1. Its implications are relentlessly depressing, therefore counterproductive. The what can we do about it, our agency, remains abstract and out of our control, rarely a happy place to land. 2. Far from being profoundly new or uniquely digital, it's a recurring narrative nearly as old as our written history. Propaganda has been a tool of war and political coercion for ages. Disinformation flourished after the invention of movable type in the 15th century, and Socrates, the godfather of knowledge, warned in the 1st century BCE about the dangers of freezing his conversations in written form, lest they be distorted or misconstrued in his absence. More recently, in the analog era, there have been concerns over the blurring of lines between content and advertising. Disinformation is a fact of life to be managed, like endemic biological viruses. Most importantly, 3, it ignores the inconvenient truth that people actively seek out disinformation. There's a demand for it, markets for it, and business people working to satisfy that demand. This is why the war on disinformation, however well-intentioned, seems as tragically misguided as the war on drugs. In both cases, there's a reasonable-sounding promise of a supply-side solution, stamping out the supply of drugs or misinformation or whatever, which in practice devolves into an endless game of whack-a-mole. In both cases, it's user demand that is the driver and continues to make these viable, though socially undesirable, businesses. Flipping the narrative. Can we flip our narrative about the perils of narrative overreach into a positive, with apologies for the meta-ness? The idea that the epistemic, let's call it the narrative, is detachable from physical reality is scary on the one hand, but on the other hand, it can be liberating when applied with care and forethought. Rather than seeing this only as a bug, we can see it also as a feature. We all love stories. They enhance our reality in interesting and enlightening ways. They make life dance. You might even say they make the world go round. Even now, the fairy tales and Greek myths my mother introduced me to as a kid continue to bring resonance and meaning to my everyday life. Any superpower can be used effectively either for good or for evil. We can and must harness the power of the narrative in a positive way for our benefit. In the organizational world, this is best known as marketing. We can refresh or even change our narrative when called for by changing circumstances, repositioning, telling our story in a new way. We might even think of marketers as organizational narrateurs, keepers, curators, stewards of the enterprise narrative flame. Hidden narratives. Some of the most insidious narratives are the hidden ones, most often supported by unquestioned assumptions. They're hard to access, deep in our collective unconscious, and often experienced as just the way things are. In one recent example, there's been a lot of research on the detrimental effects of smartphones and social media on adolescents. There's at least a correlation, if not causation, between obsessive social media use and loneliness and general unhappiness. The narrative's not always spelled out explicit message. It can be an inferred synthesis and interpretation of a pattern of smaller messages, a meta-narrative. For example, the meta-narrative that many of us apparently take away from social media is, everyone else is cooler, richer, and better looking than you. They have more friends, more fun, and overall a much more rewarding life than you. But don't worry, we're here to help you if you can't keep up. This is not healthy for anyone, and is especially damaging to young people whose values, aspirations, and sense of self and self-worth are still being formed. The self-narrative. The most compelling form of narrative is the self-narrative, the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. This is usually a pastiche of external narratives that we've stitched together into the presentation of self in everyday life. This is also true for organizations, many of whom have formal efforts to capture and codify the enterprise narrative, its purpose, its mission, its vision, its values. Organizations do well to undertake a narrative self-assessment as a first step in any significant strategy or innovation initiative. The way we've always done it can be an anchor, a barrier to pivoting in a dynamic blue or red strategic ocean. Hidden tacit assumptions are typically the main source of such barriers. Codified knowledge is especially susceptible to becoming a barrier if and when it becomes a stale proxy for how conditions actually are now. Narrative suspension. We are all continually bombarded by narratives. Our brains get fatigued and burned out, just like a muscle that, when overworked, starts to cramp and spasm. Let's harness the awesome power of the detachable narrative to help ourselves rather than hurt ourselves. Suspending a narrative can be difficult, even dangerous, especially when it's a self-narrative. While it's theoretically possible to think of narratives as plug and play, drop one out, drop a new one in reality it doesn't work like that. Why? Narratives are inherently social, and social connections are arguably more resistant to change than beliefs. In reality, there's no red pill. This takes time, focus, and will. We can begin to open that door with questions like, what narratives guide our thinking and behavior? And for the individual equivalent of any of these questions, just drop in my and I. Where do they come from? Who's enabling and driving them? Who stands to gain from them? Who loses? Why do we need them? In what ways are they helping us, hindering us, hurting us? What assumptions, hidden or not, are the result? How can we expose them if hidden and test them? Does this narrative that used to work for us still make sense given what we now know? What constitutes signal versus noise in our epistemic environment? How can we escape the Platonic cave that limits our perception and understanding? In working with an organization where any kind of change is called for, which is in some respects all of them, our essential first step in removing barriers to change consists of systematically identifying and decoding the narratives of that enterprise. We as individuals need to do this too, get our heads out of our phones and into each other as people, not least ourselves, if only for a moment, Over time, people have developed various ways of doing this. Some of these are informal, perspective-altering drugs, including alcohol, vacation and travel, games and sports, the arts. Digital detox is an essential element. I try to take my own advice, so I've developed a workflow of taking one day a week, usually Saturday, as a digital Sabbath. Minimal emails and texts, no obsessively reading and responding to LinkedIn posts, no newspapers or content sites. At the gym, I leave my phone in my locker. And other than LinkedIn, I avoid social media as much as possible, a luxury I realize not everyone can afford. Other methods are formal and subject to extended study and practice. In Zen meditation, there's a concept called beginner's mind, wherein you try to momentarily forget all you know and be here now. Even medieval monks, though free of the many electronic distractions we have today, found concentration elusive and challenging to achieve and rewarding. Convenient untruths. Do you ever use a narrative that you know is not supported by the facts? We all do, because it's easy and a good enough explanation. For example, when I ask, what time does the sun set tonight? I'm fully aware that the sun is not actually setting or moving relative to Earth. It just looks that way. Until about 500 years ago, any educated adult would have accepted that as reality. Since the development of modern astronomy, though, even a grade schooler knows that that's not literally how things work. Nonetheless, we still have sunset times listed in our weather apps. It's a convenient untruth. It's a silly example, granted, but my point is we rarely fact-check life. There's a growing body of research revealing that, quite the contrary, we typically shop for information-based rationalizations or justifications for beliefs that we've developed previously. We cherry-pick our information, in other words, to conform with our socially developed narratives. A pack of lies. When I studied finance, our professor would often get our attention by saying financial statements are a pack of lies agreed upon. His mission, of course, was to teach us how to see beneath those lies into the reality of a client's financial condition. Sometime later, I learned that this general formulation has been applied by no less than Napoleon, who would know, to history. I contend that it could apply to pretty much any organized body of knowledge. Science is arguably an exception in that it's continually tested with empirical evidence. Human knowledge is largely consensus-driven and socially reinforced. Too long, didn't read. The signifier is not the signified. Neither the epistemic world nor the physical world is the more real. They're complementary and together form the reality of our modern perceivable world. When we conflate the two or grant one dominion over the other, we run into problems, as admittedly I did in drafting this note. When they function as a seamless whole, we're making progress. We can modulate and manage their relationship for good or for not so good. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.